Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Tuesday, April 11th. By this Friday, the abortion pill, mifepristone, might become largely unavailable, you know that, if the federal court ruling in Texas last Friday night stands. The consequences of that are so huge because medication abortions are the majority of abortions in the United States today. Now, just since yesterday's show, the Biden administration has appealed for at least a longer-term stay of the Texas judge's ruling until the ultimate decision in the case, probably by the Supreme Court. There's also the competing decision by a federal court in Washington state that protects mifepristone access in 17 states. The Supreme Court will probably have to resolve the conflicting decisions. Unusual for the Supreme Court, that decision could come in a matter of days, we are told, because of the extreme implications of the Texas ruling. Also, since yesterday's show, as we continue to follow these developments, some blue state governors are taking emergency measures. As the Washington Post describes it, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced yesterday that he has secured an emergency stockpile of up to 2 million doses of misoprostol, the pill that's typically used alongside mifepristone, in a two-step regimen to perform medication abortions. Misoprostol can be used on its own to terminate a pregnancy, but the Washington Post says studies show it is less effective than the two-step regimen and usually causes more cramping and bleeding. In Massachusetts, according to this article, Governor Maura Healey announced that she is stockpiling mifepristone itself with 15,000 doses, enough to last a year in the state of Massachusetts. That stockpile is expected to arrive this week. With us now on the legal and medical implications of all this, as we continue to follow this story, is Nancy Northup, president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights, which has been a party to Supreme Court abortion rights cases, and Dr. Kristen Brandy, MD, OBGYN, and abortion provider in New Jersey, and board chair with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Nancy, welcome back. Always good to have you. Dr. Brandy, thank you for your time today. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Dr. Brandy, can you expand on that Washington Post passage on how the two abortion medications, mifepristone and misoprostol, are used separately or in conjunction with each other in your or other doctors' practice?
Absolutely. So in our gold standard regimen of medication abortion, we typically use two medications, mifepristone, which is the one in question in this court case, as well as misoprostol. We've been using this regimen for over 20 years now and have great evidence to support that it is safe and effective. That being said, we can use that second medication, misoprostol, alone in a couple of doses, and that is also safe, effective, and has been in use in other places across the country and abroad.
What would be the consequences for women? The article said in that passage that I read, it usually causes more cramping and bleeding.
Right. It's unfortunate that the second medication, misoprostol, while it works really well, does have more side effects than the combination of the two medications. So patients that take this regimen alone may have more cramping, may have more nausea, more vomiting. It may just be a less pleasant experience for them. And so this is why it's really important for us to keep medications that we know are safe and effective and have benefits like minimal side effects, like mifepristone on the market.
So, Nancy, one question some listeners had yesterday, and I'm not sure it was fully answered, was why the anti-abortion group only went after mifepristone in this lawsuit and not both abortion drugs. Do you at the Center for Reproductive Rights understand their strategy in this respect?
Well, in some ways, they really are going after both in this lawsuit. I mean, the basis for the lawsuit is they're challenging the FDA's approval of mifepristone, over 22 years ago. And so that's the base of the lawsuit. However, they also have raised the Comstock Act in their lawsuit. And this is a, 19th century morals law. That has not been in effect and certainly not used with respect to legal abortion. But there's suggestions that they may use that to try to go after both the misoprostol as well as the mifepristone. So their strategy is to ban medication abortion nationwide because, you know, they're trying to, one of the things that is so, you know, maddening, frankly, about the Dobbs decision was that, you know, the pretext there was, well, we're going to just send this back to the states and each state can decide. Unacceptable in and of itself, because we now have abortion banned in 13 states with really harmful consequences. But this isn't about letting states decide. We've got strong states like New York and California and Illinois and Michigan and so many more who support abortion rights. But there's an attempt now to remove what is the, you know, most popular, more than 50% of people choose medication abortion, you know, off the shelves in all the states. So, you know, that's the ultimate goal. And again, as we're talking today, I want to make sure your listeners understand this lawsuit is completely baseless. I mean, the decision has no grounding in law or fact. And it is just really disturbing that we are even in the situation that we are, that this opinion has issued, and that now the Department of Justice has to be up in front of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit trying to get it stayed.
We'll see if the Supreme Court agrees with you, ultimately, I guess. Dr. Brandy, let me bring you in on the points that Nancy was just making. You're a doctor, not a lawyer, but are you watching medical arguments in this legal battle? Does it look to you like this hinges at all on a medical judgment of mifepristone that your experience as a practicing OBGYN could inform?
Thanks for that. I mean, you're right, I'm not a lawyer, but in reading this case, the first thing that came to mind was just feeling so insulted by the way that it was written. It was clearly written in a way that was inflammatory, trying to evoke anti-choice emotion, really disparaging to providers like myself that just want to provide the best medical care for patients, for scientists that have studied this for decades, and really to patients that, you know, are just everyone, you know, in communities trying to get the care that they need. The way that this case was written was just so disparaging to all of these communities. So it was really heartbreaking. But in addition to that, it's also just really distressing to see how it just accepted all of this rhetoric and just ignored all of the facts. It ignored scientific language. It ignored the decades of research around this medication. It just was really insulting to the science and how we've done so much research to prove this medication works well. It actually took us 20 years. This medication was invented in the 80s, but we hadn't gotten it in the United States until the year 2000. So we had 20 years of data even before it made it to the shore here. So it's really disheartening to think about the case and how it just ignores all of the science. And I think also to Nancy's point, I'm worried about what this looks like for the future of medicine and how this will impact care. We see that this is setting a precedent where a judge with no medical background, no expertise in this area, can decide whether or not the FDA, a established, respected organization, can approve medications or not. And I worry about what's next. We talked about misoprostol, the other medication, potentially being a target. But I see this mirroring a lot of the laws we're seeing now in states around gender-affirming care. Any care that's really stigmatized could be a target. I think of things like HIV medication and PrEP, even the COVID vaccine. They could question that process and have that kind of medication overturned. And so I really worry about how not only it's insulting now, but what are the long-term implications of this law and how drugs are approved and how, you know, I can right now trust the FDA that has gone through the science to show that, you know, the medications I prescribe have a good basis and evidence. And now I'm not so sure about if that will be the process moving forward.
Dr. Brandy, I think Caroline in the Bronx has a medical question for you. Caroline, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hi. I was wondering, I Are these medications used also to aid in if someone's having a miscarriage? So I was wondering if it's also used for non-abortion care.
Thank you, doctor.
Yeah, thanks for that question. And that's a great point, that mifepristone, that drug in this case, is also used as the gold standard treatment for a miscarriage. So when we pull this medication from the shelves, it not only impacts abortion patients, but also miscarriage care. It has some other uses, things around labor care, cervical dilation, and another form of this medication is also used in endocrine disorders. I'm not clear about whether or not that will impact that particular use of this drug, but, you know, again, we talk about the broad implications about what this could do. If we lose misoprostol, that second medication, that is our standard regimen for labor induction in the country for anybody that's undergoing an induction of labor. So again, we think about this in the context of abortion, and abortion patients absolutely should be able to access the medicines that they need. But it has much more implications on medicine across the board, which is really concerning.
Mark in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I'm just wondering if you could clarify what New York State is doing in terms of stockpiling these drugs and allowing women to come to New York for abortions from states that don't allow it. What's New York doing?
Well, I know Governor Hochul has vowed to do what she can. Let's see, looking at a public radio report from Rochester right now, it says Hochul said she would push legislation that would require insurance companies to cover misoprostol, the other drug, which can be used alone but is more effective when taken with mifepristone. I think that's the only explicit thing that she said. Dr. Brandy, maybe you can shed some local light on this, because I read that Washington Post reporting earlier on the governors of California and Massachusetts taking actions to stockpile one or another of the abortion medications. You practice in New Jersey. Do you know if Governor Murphy is taking any such action, or are you or your organization calling on him to?
That's a great question. I haven't heard anything currently in New Jersey about stockpiling, although I've heard other states working on this. It's a really murky issue, because even if we stockpile this medication so that we have enough to serve the people that we can, it's still unclear whether or not, if this medication goes away, if FDA approval goes away, should we be using this medication? I will say that doctors in general are rule followers. And so if we know that this medication is no longer approved by the FDA and we are giving a medicine that is no longer approved, I know that many doctors will be dissuaded from giving this medication, even if we have it in hand, because of the power and the prestige that the FDA has. That being said, I think we should be doing everything we can, not only to stockpile mifepristone specifically, but actually more misoprostol, that second medication. While we have it, while it is FDA approved, we want to make sure we can use that regimen. And because that regimen does require a couple of doses, typically, we need to increase the manufacturing of that medication and make sure it's available to everyone that is going to have to use it now more readily for medication, abortion, and miscarriage care.
What happens in the short term, Dr. Brandy? Because one of the outcomes by the end of this week could be that the appeals process continues, and it will take a while, however long it takes. Some people say only a few days. Maybe it will take weeks or months. I don't think we really know, to get to the Supreme Court and have a final resolution. But in the meantime, that Texas judge might say mifepristone is illegal while the appeals process goes on. That's basically what he ruled on Friday, and he's going to revisit it this Friday. But could you ignore it and continue to practice using the drug? Maybe you heard Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, among others, saying, look, at least until there's a Supreme Court ruling, doctors could just ignore this, and the FDA could just ignore this. Do you have an opinion?
Sure. I mean, I think that is something that some doctors may do during this time. It's complicated. I think that particularly people that are providing abortion know that what we do is highly scrutinized, particularly in places where there's a lot of question about whether or not abortion will remain legal. There's lots of pushes of getting doctors' licenses revoked for providing abortion care, even though it's legal. They're trying to find ways to target abortion providers so that we can't provide care. And so I think that people that are providing abortion care are going to be very vigilant and trying to follow the rules as best they can. Even though I know that there's calls for us to ignore these rules in this case right now. I would say that once we heard that this case was being heard, many providers in the movement, including people within the Physicians Reproductive Health Network, have been preparing. And so many of us already have mesoprostol-only regimens ready to go to be able to provide to people. So if there's no delay in care, that people can still get medication abortion management, it will just look a little bit different. I know that some people also, if talking about side effects and talking about the experience with mesoprostol-only doses, they may choose procedural abortion instead of medication abortion. And so many clinics have been trying to figure out how we can manage more people choosing procedural abortion if that is something that we can offer in our space. And so we've been already preparing for this moment, and we will continue to do that work while we need to, but it's still really unclear.
Nancy, any legal advice you can give practitioners like Dr. Brandy?
Well, the Center for Reproductive Rights has been counseling our clients. We represent a lot of independent abortion providers across the country. That's how we came to represent the Jackson Women's Health Organization and took that case all the way to the Supreme Court in the Dobbs case. And I won't comment on the advice that we're giving to our clients, but I want to say this. I think it's very important right now that we not all get ahead of ourselves and that we keep all eyes where it belongs on accountability of the Court of Appeals to reverse this decision. There are going to be the Department of Justice already filed its brief yesterday in the U.S. Court of Appeals. The court has ordered that the plaintiffs in this case, the anti-abortion organizations and doctors, file their brief by midnight tonight. I think we're also going to see a lot of amicus. Those are friend of the court briefs. These are, organizations and viewpoints that have a particular perspective, like the American Medical Association and the Organization of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I'm expecting the pharmaceutical companies to weigh in. We're going to have all those voices coming in to the appeals process. And it's critical that this case be succeed by the Department of Justice because, doctors should not be put in the position, as Kristen was just talking about, of having to weigh their options, and the patient should have all of the scientific-based options for medication abortion. So I do want to keep us this week very focused on how wrong this decision is and the need for the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, if the Court of Appeals doesn't do its job, to overturn it. And I also just wanted to mention to your question that you got on what is from Mark on what is New York State doing. Is to also let people know that the Attorney General of New York, Tish James, immediately when the Dobbs decision came down, pulled together a reproductive health care task force of 24 national law firms and eight reproductive rights organizations, including the Center for Reproductive Rights, to launch a legal hotline. So if any of your listeners out there have questions in terms of people coming to New York to have seek abortion care, if there are providers in New York who are providing abortion care, go to the Attorney General's website, and there's a hotline, and lawyers are standing by to answer questions about being able to access care in New York.
One more call. Rachel in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Talking about what New York and New Jersey are doing to protect access to this life-saving medication, I'm wondering if anyone knows why those states aren't part of the promethrepristone lawsuit that was in Washington State.
Nancy, that's for you. And a lot of people around here are confused by that. There are these conflicting rulings by way of background. 17 states for the moment are protected by the Washington State federal judge's ruling in terms of mifepristone availability. But New York and New Jersey, very blue, very abortion rights states, were not among the 17 states that filed that suit, protecting them for now. Do you understand why not?
I can't speak for New York or New Jersey, but I do think it's, and we'll see what happens, you know, next. It's often the case that others who, you know, have standing to join a lawsuit can join even after the initial lawsuit is filed. So we'll see what happens next on that. But yes, it's important for your listeners to know that there is a separate lawsuit in the state of Washington that was filed, in which a judge on Friday issued an opinion saying the FDA needs to not make any changes around mifepristone while the lawsuit in Washington state is pending. And that's really the right. And yesterday, the Department of Justice asked for more clarification on that ruling from the judge in Washington state, because they do have these conflicting rulings. But, you know, it just brings up the important point that, again, shows how outcome oriented, how ideological, how predetermined the judge in Amarillo was, because what he's granted here is what's called a preliminary injunction. And preliminary injunctions are for the purpose of keeping the status quo when a lawsuit is filed, so that it can be worked out and changes are not made before the actual merits of a decision. And here, the plaintiffs have not met any of the standards for a preliminary injunction, which, among other things, you need to show that you're going to succeed on the merits, but you also need to show that there's an emergency need for the public interest. Mm. None of these are met here. The status quo, as the Washington judge knows and ruled correctly, is to keep things as it has been for 23 years, which is mifepristone has been approved based on the evidence by the FDA.
Nancy Northup is president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Dr. Kristen Brandy, MD, OBGYN, abortion provider in New Jersey, is also board chair with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.